Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have on the show today for the first time Jacqueline Michard. We'll be discussing Still Summer, which is recently published by Warner Books. And first of all, Jackie, thanks so much for appearing on the show today.
I'm delighted. I think I'm in really good company.
Well, I like to think we both are. I would like to mention as well that Cage of Stars is coming out in paperback at about the same time that Still Summer is being released. So congratulations on Still Summer, which I read with great interest, and I think your readers are going to really like.
I hope that they do. It's the first time I've tried anything in this genre, which I don't know. My friend Craig Holden said that it was a new genre called chick noir. He said that it was, no one could call it chick lit because these women were up against anything equal to the kind of test of survival that people would face in a much grimmer place on Everest or in a desert, except that they're in the middle of the Caribbean Ocean, stranded in the middle of the ocean. And he said that it really, it wasn't so much about family relationships and probing relationships as what happens to people as the layers of civility are peeled away.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to explore that on a 52-foot boat, you know, of which perhaps, you know, there's probably 60 square feet of living space. What would happen to four people as they got closer and closer to having to face their own mortality?
Mm-hmm. And that's a very good description of the book. And there's actually kind of a fifth character, Janice, who comes into the novel later on. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the four women that form the core of Still Summer, Tracy, Holly, Olivia, and then Cammy is the 19-year-old daughter of Tracy. So they were known as the godmothers back in high school, and I think most of us can relate to groups of people that we hung out when we were in high school. And these women have maintained that close friendship over the years, haven't they?
They have. They were sort of a west side of Chicago clique of greaser girls,
mm-hmm.
Of the kind that I knew and grew up with when I was a teenager in the 70s. And they were the girls that everybody wanted to be and everybody wanted to know. They weren't bad enough to get bad grades, but they were bad enough to be envied.
Mm-hmm.
And the daughter is a girl who's completed her freshman year at college and is in full late-term rebellion against everything her mother and her father stand for. That late-coming character, Janice, that you spoke of is the cousin of Tracy, Cammy's mother, and begs off of the trip because of a family emergency at the last moment. And Cammy and her mother, who are embattled, head off to the Caribbean with Tracy's lifelong best friend, whose name is Holly, and to rendezvous with another one of their number who has lived abroad for 20 years. She married an Italian vintner and has lived in Italy for 20 years. She's a widow now, a young widow at 42. And this cruise is supposed to be the way that they reunite and welcome Olivia back to the United States. It turns out to be something very different.
Mm-hmm. And I really like you really probe the boundaries of friendship with the situations that you put the characters in, because I think we all like to think that we would behave in a certain way and that we're above certain behavior, but as their situation becomes more serious, you really, the characters are put in situations of survival. And I found it interesting to see, like, the mother-daughter bond is, you know, is probably one of the strongest. And the friendships, they test the limits of those as well.
The mother-daughter bond, yeah, the petty nature of the disagreements between Tracy and her daughter, Cammie or Camille, it dissolve. I mean, they work together as a team with considerable physical strength and considerable endurance and ingenuity and engineering ability. I mean, Cammie's studying to be an engineer, and her mother is an athlete, has been an athlete and has taught physical education all of her adult life. And they work together, whereas Olivia, who has been taken care of all her adult life, though she's had a very meager, lonely childhood. It's sort of like aging, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Crisis is, I think, is sort of like what my daughter Francie called the olding process instead of the aging process.
Mm-hmm.
As you go through the olding process, I think you don't really change. You just become more like you already were.
I agree.
And what these people become as literally they begin to wonder whether they're going to survive at all and what the nature of their survival is going to be, because they're at the end of the tourist season. There's no one left on in the sea between St. John's and Grenada except for the kind of people who you would never want to run into.
Mm-hmm.
Not Johnny Depp, you know, not
right.
pirates, you
right.
know, but
right.
real modern day pirates of the Caribbean who really do look for ships to and boats to prey on the people on them and get what they can, and people are lucky to get away with their lives or their boats. And so you know, Olivia, who always seems so generous to her godchild Cammie, becomes very self-centered, very self-protective, and Holly, who was the member of the group that was kind of allowed to tag along, not as quite as cool as the other girls, reveals herself to be extraordinarily brave.
Mm-hmm.
And also the only one possessed of any medical knowledge, because she's a nurse.
Yes, you used the phrase in the introduction, I believe, you dedicated it to Niece Kyle, who exhibited grace under distress. And that seemed to be kind of a theme in this book, is people handle extreme stress either with a sense of grace or by doing the kind of things that tend to be self-serving and destructive to the other members of the group.
Right. And the only way that a group in peril can survive is by absolute cooperation. And that doesn't happen aboard the Opus, which is the name of the yacht. I should say, you know, I put the cart in front of the horse in a sense, because I should say that the reason that they're in this fix, they didn't set out to do what's called a bareboat cruise, where people with more enthusiasm than experience rent a sailboat and decide they're going to go and sail the seven seas. That's a real recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
They set out with a very experienced crew on a chartered crossing, a chartered 10-day crossing, but because of a mishap that happened in an instant,
mm-hmm.
They were separated from the crew and thrown upon their own resources at the same time that the boat was disabled, its electrical and communication system was disabled. And how often that happens, you cannot imagine.
Really?
How often that happens. I was stunned. I mean, you know, I grew up on the west side of Chicago. You know, my father remembers being a boy when World War II began, and when they talked about, you know, the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor, he thought that that was like Navy Pier.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't grow up a worldly person. But some of my friends who are authors also, Beth Gutchen, the author of More Than You Know, and Leeway Cottage, and Patricia Kessling Wood, who lived on a sailing boat in Hawaii, all tried to help me make the nautical details authentic. And they were shocked at how little happened to these women.
Okay.
At how much restraint I used in the incidents that befell them, because they said that in a situation like the situation in which these four women found themselves, anything that could happen would, and that sailing, like flying, is very safe, but it's not forgiving. As soon as one thing goes wrong, everything goes wrong, and it goes wrong fast.
Mm-hmm. Now, stylistically, Jackie, when you were writing Still Summer, the book has a little bit of an element of almost like a locked room mystery, in terms of you're pretty centered on where the action is going to take place. Was that a difficult thing to deal with artistically, that being centered right there in the middle of the ocean, not have people really be able to get away from the boat?
No, it was fun. It was a challenge, but it was fun. And to me, I wanted the way that the book was written to be as claustrophobic in tone as the experience would have been.
Mm-hmm.
So that the reader could not flash back to, except in very brief periods when the women were talking about their high school days, and those were very brief indeed before the tragedy, the initial tragedy, that there would be no escape, there would be no relief, that it would stay centered in the place where they were and move along basically in real time.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge that I set forth for myself was that I was going to write this book, you know, in a series of 20 days, and each of the chapters would comprise the events of that day. And of course, as time moved on, both more happened and less happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. You're listening to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. My guest today is Jacqueline Michard. We're discussing Still Summer, recently published by Warner Books. And, Jackie, when you talk about that, you do have to factor in what happens to the characters as the situation becomes more grave. And it's the day we're talking, it's about 95 degrees outside. And just a few days in that kind of heat, you start to really realize that things can go south pretty quickly in this kind of weather.
Isn't it funny? Yeah, that was another thing that was so important for me as I was writing this book, for people to understand, was that the very place that you would consider paradise, the very place that you would consider a paradise could... In moments, become hell.
Mm-hmm.
Could become a place, a prison from which there was no escape. You know, just the featureless ocean and the beautiful sunshine that had been what they sought for peace and for solace became this enemy, this pitiless creature without it, with a very random goddess,
mm-hmm.
you know, with
mm-hmm.
no regard for them at all, and suddenly they were at the mercy of those elements, and without land in sight, without any way to reach anybody else, even if anybody else was around, the very thing that they sought turned into the thing that they had to escape in order to try to survive.
Yes, it's I like that aspect of the book, and I I imagine the people are going to identify with different characters. And I have a 22-year-old stepdaughter, and I was laughing out loud at the start of the book with some of the dialogue between Camille and Tracy. And I think most of your readers will, too, because it's that typical, like you say, rebellion thing. But it is nice to see the maturity that evolves and how tight that bond is. But I laughed out loud because I'd heard some of those arguments in my own home.
I realize that something in every book, that I write, and this is my eighth novel for adults, something in every book that I write has a grain of something that's going on in my own life in it.
Mm-hmm.
And my oldest son is in a period right now where he just doesn't want to know me. I mean, we are very similar. We have similar politics. You know, we had private jokes, and all of a sudden this whole relationship has come under extreme duress. And I realized that what I do, and what I looked back at other books, and I looked back at other books, the first book that I wrote, The Deep End of the Ocean, I realized that I was writing about a big Italian family in the restaurant business, because my husband had just died, and he was part of a big Italian family in the restaurant business. And so, in a sense, that book was both a new beginning for me and also a mourning of everything that I was leaving behind with his death. And this book is a meditation on that part of that inevitable part of all of our adult lives when our children reject us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes our children, if we're not, I like to think if we're not complete and utter jerks, our children at some time in their lives, often when they have children of their own or when they have a little experience with living on their own, come back to appreciate what they had in their parents. But there's a point in life, and it's between the ages of, I would say, 18 and 23, when kids just think that that their parents are gross and hopelessly doddering, and their ideas are foolish, and their politics are the things that they appreciate are embarrassing and doltish, and it's just I think that they think that we should just quietly phase ourselves out like some kind of species that no longer belongs on the earth, and when we don't do that, it's I think it goes from annoyance to anger.
Yeah.
The reaction.
Yes, and it, part of that is the separation. You know, it's in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I know this is going to improve, but it can be very trying at times, to put it mildly.
Well, in the back of your mind, you know, I empathized greatly with Tracy, both because I don't know that character very well. There are other characters. There are characters in the novel that I think I know better than I know her, but I admired her tolerance with her daughter because I'm a hot reactor, and if some of my kids, and I have a lot of kids, some of my older kids push the buttons that they know exactly where the buttons are located, they're going to get what they wanted, which is an explosion from their mom. And Tracy was able to sort of just shrug off. So she adores her child and was able to shrug off so much of Cammie's casual cruelty. And I'm not able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of a, you know, I have very tender feelings. They're close to the surface. Before we started the show, we were talking about, I think briefly about people who are creative. I was thinking about this anyway before we started. People who are creative tend to be at the opposite, emotionally at the opposites of human sort of human behavior and human feeling, pretty generally. Mm-hmm. at the polar ends of that. Either they're buoyant with joy, or they feel despair. And I don't mean that we're bipolar,
right?
But people who are creative feel things, I think, deeply, and it's really difficult to intellectualize them.
Yeah, I agree. Jackie, you mentioned that you're doing some young adult or books as well, and when I looked at your website, which is JacquelineMachard.com, I saw you had a section for teens only, and being a compliant person, I didn't click on it. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your interest in that, your website, the teens only part, because it seems like you have a passion for some different causes and different things, and that struck me as something that would be interesting to talk about.
Well, on my website, I want my website to be not just a series of a collection of my good reviews,
mm-hmm.
and a place where none of my bad reviews are allowed, and a place where you can buy my books and hear and read an interview with me. I want it to be sort of a clubhouse,
mm-hmm.
where people can talk about things, about my books, about other books, about issues in society. The podcast, for example, that I that is on my website right at this moment is called The Forgotten Man, and it was about a guy I met on a bus at Logan Airport who was a veteran coming home from Iraq who had both legs amputated just above the knee.
Wow.
And he had been, I mean, this sounds like I made it up, but I didn't make it up. I mean, he was an Irish guy from Boston, and he had been a dancer, you know, an Irish dancer. And he wasn't going to be doing that anymore. And it reminded me of the old Clancy Brothers song the band played, Waltzing Matilda. I don't know if you've ever heard
mm-hmm.
that, but it was about Gallipoli. And I thought it was the podcast that I did was about how little we have learned about killing the green corn,
mm-hmm.
and how little war has changed in 100 years. It's still the same thing. It still does the same thing. It still does the same thing to the people who deserve it least. And you know, there are some other things on there. I am an activist for research to try to find cures and a cure, if possible, or therapies for multiple sclerosis, which my best friend from childhood has, and which was one of the characters in one of my novels called The Breakdown Lane. It was 2 years ago. Had multiple sclerosis and was a had been a dancer. My friend was an actor, and there are all kinds of things on there. But I must tell you, I am right now. I'm very passionate about the young adult novels that I am writing. I just am delighting in it. It's
good.
Not unless you're Meg Cabot and write The Princess Diaries, which, you know, she's an adorable person and wrote. Has written some amazing young adult books. It isn't perhaps the most lucrative mm-hmm. or noticed kind of writing, but there are more chances, perhaps because that's true, you can take more chances than you can take perhaps with adult fiction, because there's a certain parameter of kinds of things that are expected from a given writer. I'm writing, for example, a series of young adult mysteries.
Oh, good.
That are about twins, born 1 minute and before and 1 minute after New Year's Eve. Uh-huh. So they're identical twins. They'll never have the same birthday and never be the same age.
Oh, cool.
In the same year. And they are psychic with each other, as I think many identical twins are, have a certain psychic bond with each other that's not anything supernatural. But at their 13th birthday, there's an event that occurs that allows them to their dismay, which they don't want anything to do with this, to see things that have happened to other people or will happen to other people. One of them can only see the past and one can only see the future. But they're children. And so what they can do to intervene, you know, as mm-hmm. people who are only 13, 4, 14 years old, is very limited. The last thing they want to do is for people to find out that they're unusual.
Sure. That's a fascinating precept there. I like that. Well, we were talking before we went on the air. I like Alice Hoffman's young adult novels as well. I think some of her things she's written are outstanding as well. So I'm glad to hear that you're pursuing that, because it's a nice change of pace for you, I imagine, is it right?
It is a wonderful, and I love her young adult novels, particularly Aquamarine,
mm-hmm.
which is my little girls spent all of this past summer watching the movie made from Aquamarine over and over and over and over until I can quote lines from that movie and book in my sleep. But Alice's, you know, all of Alice's work is bewitching, and
yes.
It has a quality like no other. I mean, she's different from every other writer, and there are no successful imitators.
No.
And she and I joke often because of among the writers who we know, Alice is a high school dropout. I was the first person in my family ever to go to college, and I didn't study writing. I went to the state school and studied to be a teacher. And we're surrounded by people who have doctorates in
right.
creative writing from
right.
Princeton.
Right.
And
right.
Many other people have done much more in the service of learning their art than she has or I have. I just read all the books in the library. Well, that's how, if I have learned to write, and, you know, there are those who would certainly dispute that, but let's posit for a minute that I know how to write somewhat. I'm completely self-taught. I went to college, and I took creative writing as the freshman elective, you know, other than, I mean, you could choose rhetoric, or you
mm-hmm.
could choose some other kind of English elective that was mandatory, but I took creative writing, and that's the only creative writing class I have ever taken. And I've never read a book about writing. I think that books about writing, while they may be interesting and instructive, are, for my students, when I teach at workshops, for example, I find that they often use them as a way to not write, as a way to postpone writing.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
You know, by reading about it and reading about it endlessly and reading this person, you know, reading
right.
Anne Lamott's view of it or Natalie Goldberg's view of it or Nora Roberts' view of it and never really getting down to making their own, to finding their own voice and making their own case. And whenever people who are young or they don't have to be young, who are new writers, whether they're young or not young, ask me, what would you recommend that I read to learn how to write? I say, read your betters. You know,
mm-hmm.
read people who know how to do this better than you do.
Absolutely. There's a yin and a yang to it. You have to read to be able to write, I think.
Well, yes, but you'd be stunned if I were to tell you the number of people I know who are published writers who say to me regularly, I wouldn't say half, but a goodly number of people who are published writers whose names you would know who say to me, I don't have time to read.
Hmm.
And that's like, and they say to me, you have 7 children. You know, you and you write a young adult book a year and an adult book a year. How do you have time to read? And truly, without being dramatic, it's like saying, how do you have time to breathe? You
right.
know,
it's
absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't go back to that well, and you find yourself stewing in your own juices, and your own juices can become thin and I think even poisonous
mm-hmm.
to a writer after a while. I think of Anne Rice, for example, because mm-hmm. I think that Anne Rice's book, Interview with the Vampire, was a magnificent book. And then her writing deteriorated so much, probably by virtue of its own acclaim, and I think because she didn't have time to turn around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she really didn't have time to turn around and consider her work because there was such a demand for it. It's a danger. I mean, it's a danger to people who are having a time in their lives in which their work is so eagerly sought. And the wise ones, I'm thinking of Gregory Maguire and Alice Hoffman and some others, the wise among them will take the time rather than the money.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we'll put Andre Dubuque III in that category as well.
Yeah. I mean, he could certainly... He could certainly earn great quantities of money if he were more prolific. But everything that he does without compromise.
Exactly.
Absolutely without compromise. At least I think so. I respect him greatly for that.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's you know, yes, I do write for a living. But I'm not going to put my name or my reputation on something that I can't feel satisfied with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that attitude because I mean, for me, I'm like you. I mean, if I have a stack of books that I have to read, some books I want to read, some I'd like to read, and I kind of go back and forth between the three piles. They really don't have any credibility as piles.
Right, I understand.
Well, Jackie, I
read for research. I read for pleasure. I read for instruction. I read for sustenance. I've taught. I mean, most of my children read for pleasure. There's one of my children who doesn't enjoy reading, but most of them. Most of them do. Most of them see that it's sort of that it's a movable feast.
Yes.
It's a portable pleasure like no other.
That's great.
I mean, you can't replace it with an iPad.
I agree completely. Well, Jackie, I have really enjoyed our conversation today.
So have I.
And congratulations on Still Summer. And I look forward to getting caught up with you down the road when the next book comes out. So let's do this again on a regular basis when your new book's
coming out.
All right.
Okay? All right, I'm game for that. Thank you, Casey.
Okay, take care.